Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Brainwaves, hear the world differently. Bringing community mental health to you, raising awareness and challenging stigma. Tune in to 3CR Community Radio, Wednesdays at 5pm.
Melbourne's Drive Time Radio program, featuring community organisations, powerful stories and information. Find us at brainwaves.org.au. Proudly sponsored by Wellways Australia.
I would like to begin by paying my respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which I am coming to you from today. Land where at Brainwaves we tell our stories, and land where the traditional custodians have told their stories for many, many years before us, and continue to tell their stories. I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners who are listening today.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Brainwaves on 3CR 855am, 3CR Digital Radio and 3cr.org.au. My name's Mark, and today we'll be presenting the last part of the 24th Annual Woodcock Lecture that was held by Wellways earlier this year on the 29th of May at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. The evening brought together mental health advocates, peer workers, clinicians, and people with lived experience around the central theme of how to centre dignity and humanity in the mental health system. If you didn't catch the first parts of this series, you can find them on the website at brainwaves.org.au or on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au. This episode will feature part two of a panel discussion led by Mary O'Hagan, Director of Lived Experience at Wellways, on the shared role we play in building a more compassionate mental health system. The panellists of this discussion include Giancarlo De Vera, Maria Katsinas, and Associate Professor Harry Hill. We hope you'll enjoy the rest of their discussion.
And Harry, you might be interested to know that I think the college has most recently released a lived experience strategy.
They have, I think, and it's a Victorian Simon.
So it's come a long way.
It has, it's changing.
There are those small changes, that are happening. I've also been involved in terrible training on e-learning modules where I've just seen those woeful pictures of sad. This is Maria. She has depression. How can we help Maria? And I go, in my way, basically. But, you know, sometimes we do have other ways to go.
And I guess getting back to your question about how has it changed my practice, I think when I started it, the local was obviously a very new world, and there was nothing to look at because it hasn't really been done before. And I think what shaped, you know, one of the things that I'm really proud about is that we've had two models of care that we wanted to make sure our service was accessible, because I think that's the major barrier, you know. And new services, especially in regional areas, they open and within a couple of weeks they're closed, you know. So you're lucky if you get in the front door, but then there's a waiting list that you can never access. So we wanted to make sure our front door always stayed open. But in doing that, we had to be honest, and honest with ourselves, but honest with our community, that we were going to aim to provide good enough care, but we couldn't be the perfect care for everybody ongoing, because then the front door would close. But shock horror, good enough is actually probably better than perfect in most instances, if you use this self-determination, self-efficacy model that we're talking about. And people like honesty. Yeah. And I think if in having the peers at the front that were honest and actually have buy-in about the service mission and the service goals and kind of express that honestly, I think in the now 3 years that we've been open, I don't think anyone's ever complained, put a complaint in about the service being too short or, you know, not getting the care that they need, because we were honest about what our limitations were right from the front. And I think that's kind of what's been missing a lot in terms of services. There's this kind of idea of people not being honest or authentic about what they're doing. So the other thing that's really shaped my practice is this idea of just how important it is to address people as more than just their symptoms or more than just what's in front of them, but that whole system that's behind. And things like social prescribing, where we actually get people connected with community, connected with peers, growing their self-confidence, you see them grow and thrive. And
yeah. Actually, on that point, I wanted to jump in and clear value. What that I see in peer workers working with clinicians is that it's kind of like the bridge between the clinicians and the social determinants that allow that person to thrive and live well in the community. Like, you know, people don't need to be told, I can't access that service because that funded is, like, the funding only covers this, you know what I mean? Or the envelope only covers that. Like, it's not how humans access services, nor should they access services this way. But peer workers allow for clinicians to do the social prescribing, to do the work of connecting the social determinant dots, so we can be better placed to address the things that are not medical in nature, but are still driving our mental health challenges.
What are your hopes and dreams for the peer workforce in 5 to 10 years? I mean, and do you have any concerns about how it's all heading with the peer workforce?
I don't have concerns. I have hope. You know, I shout out to Tim earlier. Like, he does a lot of work in this space as well. We're heading in the right direction. But I want to see peer workers, like I said in my speech, in all settings, not just the mental health settings. I want to see peer workers in settings where anyone can experience mental health distress and mental health challenges. It seems really odd to me that that you got to pick your setting to be mentally, you know, challenged. Like, you got to pick your setting, you know. So why aren't there peer workers in the education system? Why aren't there peer workers in the justice system? Why aren't there peer workers in any setting where people experience mental health challenges? It just makes sense. And so when you ask the question, where do I want to see peer workers in the next 5 to 10 years? I want to see peer workers everywhere. I want to see them valued. I want to see them respected. And I want to see them as partners.
Yeah. Great. Giancarlo,
On one thing, because I think you raised a really important word in what you just said, and that is hope.
Yeah.
I think hope is the lifeblood, right, for people who work in mental health reform and advocacy, because without hope, we lose everything. It is hope that sustains us, the impasses, the blocks, the red tapes, the routine kind of violence that kind of spurs us and drives us forward. And the question then therefore becomes, how do we maintain and sustain that hope, both at an individual level, but also at a systems level?
Yeah, and also the hope one we have to have in order to lead our own recovery.
That's
as
right.
Well.
So,
Giancarlo, you kind of said in your speech that we cannot have a humane system if we have the use of a Mental Health Act. Is that what you were saying?
Oh, I said we should repeal mental health acts that that involuntarily treats and coerces people.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sorry.
How hard is it to be humane when you've got a mental health act?
We really need to see mental health acts do two key things. The first is, as I said just then, remove coercive treatment and involuntary treatment. The second is preserve and respect the legal capacity for people to make the decisions that impact their lives. Yeah. It's all too easy, all too routinely abrogated, that legal capacity. It's all too easy for someone to just say, oh, that person, it's in their best interest, or it's in the interest of the community that they should be treated by doing this instead. They are robbed of their agency. And so if you can do those two things with mental health laws, then you can create a system for supported decision-making and the ascertainment of what's known as rule of preference in the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. But the thing is, though, these legal changes, they're relatively new. It started off in Peru, funnily enough, out of all places, early in 2019. We're 6 years later. Civil law countries like Peru obviously have a very different legal system to countries like ours, where we have a common law system, and we only have countries like in some jurisdictions in Canada and Ireland who have done something novel in the last 2 years. And so all I'm saying is that we need to be brave and start imagining what that future can look like, because it's at the forefront of what that looks like. The world is grappling with that. And Australia, at least in this state, is doing better because you have human rights legislation in place. But in states like mine and New South Wales, where we don't, those mental health acts routinely get misused.
Yeah. Harry, can you imagine a world without compulsory treatment? And what would it look like if you can?
When I think about it, I think often, and I remember when the Royal Commission was happening, I was at a conference and somebody from, I think, Safer Care Victoria was having a chat, and I think their thing was, how can we reduce restrictive interventions? And all the focus at the time was very much centred around the actual time that the restrictive intervention was happening. And that's really important. But restrictive interventions often come as an outcome of all these things that we didn't do I'm not going to say weeks, months, years as a society to be able to help people to change the sequelae of events, to make things more accessible, to make sure that people had their human rights that were being addressed as a community. So in the current landscape, it's kind of like we use the mental health a lot because we don't have the resources put into other aspects of human life. And I think the more resource-limited environments that you go to often, where we don't have access to things, we end up being more restrictive or more medication-focused because there isn't the alternative. It's not about the Mental Health Act, but it's actually about the Severe Substance Dependence Act in Victoria. Yeah. So I'm an addiction psychiatrist, and if I got a dollar for every time somebody rang me saying we need to put Giancarlo on the Severe Substance Dependence Act, for whatever it might be. And when you actually sit down and you meet with the person, often you kind of have to kind of hold your breath and say, no, I don't think that's going to be suitable for this person. But let's use this as an opportunity to kind of meet with the person, bring in a meeting, get all the interested parties in and see what we can do to help the person. Often what we find in that is that the person doesn't need to be on the Severe Substance Dependence Act because they actually want help or they want to do something, but there's limits and barriers for that to be achieved. And their housing situation, their financial situation, you know, domestic violence in their relationship, these other drivers are at play. But it creates a conversation to actually make change, and the act is kind of meaningless. The thing that makes that so important is it's so difficult to actually utilise the Severe Substance Dependence Act, whereas in Victoria there's only probably 10 or 20 people a year that are treated under that act. It's not like the Mental Health Act where one psychiatrist can scribble something on a piece of paper and that's good for 24, 48 hours. When I locum in New South Wales, I feel really uncomfortable because it's actually harder to treat somebody in the community under the Mental Health Act than it is to treat them in hospital. You know, you have to go before a tribunal to put somebody in a community treatment order, but I can just scribble on a piece of paper and I can keep them in hospital for 28 days. So it's, you know, it's that skewing of so I think the act and the writing of the act, it's all very complex, and I think the what we do as a community and the interventions we make a difference as well to that end outcome of a world where the Mental Health Act is very different.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm terribly curious. It doesn't really matter what's in a Mental Health Act, as long as it authorises compulsory treatment. The compulsory treatment just goes on and on at similar rates, no matter what's in the act. But anyway, I want to go over to a more system view, Maria, which your eyes are looking at the ceiling thing.
Oh no, here I come.
Because you know, I think most of us in this room would say we really need, you know, pretty profound reform in the mental health system. But you know, if you've been around as long as I have, you know that history. And I'm getting historical, that history is littered with failed reforms. We are at the sort of aching, maybe, end of a reform process in Victoria that seems to have disappeared into delays, rollbacks and lack of budget support. And you know, someone who's worked a lot in government, what does it take for governments to follow through with ambitious reforms? Or conversely, what so often stops them from completing them?
It's the next new shiny thing that stops them from completing it, if I'm going to be really kind of honest here. I haven't been in government for about 10 years now, but when I was last in government, the big piece I worked on was what came out of the Family Violence Royal Commission. hot on the agenda, on everyone's agenda, top of the agenda, in what we would call, you know, the authorising environment. And then the shiny new thing became duller and duller, and people realised we can't have... When we're talking about another system here, another complex, slow-to-turn-around system. When we don't have those instant kind of results, it loses its attraction, and it just... The light dims out of the shiny new thing. And then we're distracted. Look, there's another shiny new thing over there. And look, it's another Royal Commission in mental health reform. And let's be clear that at the beginning, here was a reform process that had the highest political authority and mandate. The then Premier and the then Deputy Premier as Minister, very tightly held. And what have we seen over time? We've seen the shine and the mandate and the authority dim, so it's going down like this, coupled against a pretty tough kind of fiscal environment. So what does it need? It needs to be a priority instead of something like, I'm going to be controversial now because I'm not in government anymore, like the suburban rail loop, which is the next shiny new thing, right? So that's where that is. That's where that is now. And over the course of, and I'm on the board of a statutory authority, but given notice that I'm not going to be there in 3 months' time, so let me loose. But we've also seen in that time, when I think about the political ownership, right, we have seen two premiers and how many ministers? Three ministers? Four ministers. I'm kind of trying to count. And the ownership diminishes over each. So that's one of the things why reform is hard, because we don't stay the course and we don't navigate the difficulties. Instead, we want the quick wins, and so our heads are turned to the next shiny thing. So that's one aspect. The second aspect of it, when we think about system reform, is who owns... Ownership is not the right word, sorry. Who can see the system in its entirety? All of us here on this stage occupy a part of the system. And sometimes we might occupy multiple parts, whether it's the personal part that we play, as the an institutional role as I have as a deputy chair or as a CEO, or the individual roles that we have as people with, you know, lived experience of mental ill health, or it's the fact that, you know, we are in a community setting. I'm in a statutory authority, you're in the clinical setting, and we know our patch.
Yeah.
And we see our system through that patch.
Yeah, yeah.
But who steps back, zooms out, and sees the complexity of this system with its interconnected parts?
Yes, and there's also another sort of dimension to that, which is my next question, because, Giancarlo, you said the change is already here. The future does not need to wait. What about the ever-present power of history? Because you're talking about the environment and the present, but we also have the power of history and how that juggernaut of a system keeps surviving decade after decade, century after century, that hospital-based juggernaut. And so what's your view about that, and anyone who wants to comment on that?
I would argue, it is a juggernaut, and it is decade after decade. But incrementally, bit by bit, right? Bit by bit, it is shifting, right? Over that decade, if we're going to go kind of...
We don't live long enough to see it.
And what propels the juggernaut forward... It is the hope that people have for system reform and for keep driving through and for keeping to persevere, right? Yeah. It is about perseverance and it is about a kind of resilience.
Yes.
That you know, it's like, sorry, I just finished rewatching for season one of The Handmaid's Tale because it's just finished, right? I'm going to go back. You know, don't let the bastards grind you down, said Offred, right? That's what she said, the Latin. Don't let the bastards grind you down. And that's what I know. At an individual level, I have to hold when I have to deal with a, you know, the impasses, and we can't do this because of the rules, or we can't do that because of the rules, and you just inch forward. Sometimes you just need to smash it, and sometimes, you know, try to do that. But it's a combination of the both. Yep. And sometimes it is also about the alliances we forge collectively. It's not just about the individual power, it is about that collective power of a movement. And given your history, Mary, if you go back, I'm not saying you're old, but if you go back... But no, if we were, I mean, I'm old too, but, you know, I'm grandma, but if we go back, but if you go back 30 years ago, even to when I started in mental health advocacy, for me it was around about 2008, I can see those kind of changes.
Yeah, I see changes too. What worries me, and I really like your comments on this, Giancarlo, but you're not as old as I am, look, there's been a lot of changes. We've got peer workforce, we've got leadership, we've got a few more crumbs of community services, and so on. I do not see any evidence that the life and health outcomes for people who actually use services are getting any better, and nobody actually really measures it. And that's what really matters to me, and that's what saps my hope when I think it's not getting any better. And it'd be really good to get people's comments on that.
I'll touch on on that last point in a second, Mary, but I wanted to respond to Maria's comments. Before my role at Being, I led policy and advocacy at the National Peak Body for People with Disability Australia. And over the 6 years I was with them, we actually learnt to use history in our favour. And we did, and I said this in my speech where I said we needed to embed co-design, not as a buzzword, but as a structural imperative. And that was done through alliance, like Maria said. We worked with all the relevant peaks, which were, there were many, and involved a lot of stakeholders. But what we did and all we can, was just prosecute the very simple message, you cannot do this, nothing about us without us. And that set the history. That set the convention. That convention made ministers and undid ministers. That portfolio still remains as one of the biggest political hot potatoes that anyone doesn't want to have on cabinet. And that's because we are still grappling with what does co-design mean. People with disability know what that means, but it's a government who isn't fulfilling that promise. And so I would say in the mental health system, we need something similar. We need something where we can use history to our advantage and say, well, why would you not want to co-design with us? Why would you not want to co-produce us? You've been doing this for the last 6 years. Why are you changing all of a sudden? It's really hard to work backwards when you've locked in that convention. That's the beauty about conventions. So you can use history to your favour is my first point in response to that. On the point of data, I think this is where I get a bit nerdy. I sit on the Australian Government's National Disability Data Asset Council, and I think there's a huge role for people with lived experience to play in understanding what data sets we need to be able to understand our own lived experiences. Those data sets are owned by data custodians, governments primarily, but they don't do anything for... they're not framed for us. They're not. They don't answer the questions that we want to be that we want to answer. Like, I couldn't tell you how many CAL people with disability are non-binary, you know, and has a mental health condition. I couldn't, but I want to know that. And so, how could I possibly know that if and advocate for evidence-based, data-driven policy reform without that? So, people with lived experience have a role to play in understanding what data we is collected about us, how that data is interpreted, how that data is then applied, and then how that data is then used to be able to refine services that we access.
Absolutely, yeah.
Can I just touch on a little? Yes. If we even go beyond the data at kind of a population level, but one of the interesting things that's happening in our service at the moment is that kind of quality measure is what we're doing, providing quality outcomes that you said, so we can share that. And it's really interesting. So, you know, often it's not a great measure, but state-funded services are literally just contact hours is often how they're measured. And, you know, how many hours did somebody write on a piece of paper that they spent with somebody? And then when they bring in these quality measures, often these measures are ground, are kind of clinical quality measures that they... And then we establish peer workforces that are doing really meaningful work, and then we're asking a peer worker to use a clinical tool to validate their outcomes of their and I think we've got a duty to kind of reflect that that's not fit for purpose, and yeah. that we shouldn't try to, what is it, put a round hole through a square peg, and that it's our duty then to actually say, well, we value what we're doing, how can we create a quality measure that validates the human experience and validates the delivery of work that the peer worker's doing. Yeah. So I think Wellways is doing some work on that, which is a really exciting project, but yeah. I think if we want to demonstrate the work that we're doing, we've got to have the tools that back that up.
Thank you for tuning into Brainwaves this evening. Be sure to join us next week when we'll be having a chat with Sasha from the Trans Action Network. We'll be having a chat about their recent ADHD diagnosis, navigating the mental health system as a non-binary person, and the activism they're a part of. So be sure to check that out. Until then, if you'd like to send us an email with some show ideas, or perhaps you'd like to join us on Brainwaves to share your story, please get in touch. We can be reached at brainwaves@wellways.org. We're going to close out the show this week with a song called Same But Different by The Silencio. Take care and stay warm out there. We look forward to you joining us next week for another episode of Brainwaves on 3CR. Oh,
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.